Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KALW's weekly radio magazine of the performing arts. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. This week we'll learn about the Berkeley Rep production of For Peter Pan on Her 70th Birthday from starring actress Kathleen Chalfant. Conductor Ming Luke and tenor Brian Thorsett talk about the Berkeley Community Chorus and Orchestra's performance of Britten's War Requiem next week in celebration of the 50th anniversary of the BCCO. Brian will also talk about his role in Curious Flight's production of Mark Blitzstein's Airborne Symphony this Saturday, which I will have the distinct pleasure of narrating. We'll also hear from Curious Flight's director, Brendan Guy. Actor Corey Fisher talks about his show Lightning in the Brain at the Marsh, and Rob Melrose and Paul Walsh start things off sharing details about a dream play at the Cutting Ball Theater, concluding the Cutting Ball's Cutting Edge season. Ticket giveaways also part of the mix, so stay tuned. Ball Theater closes its 17th season with August Strindberg's A Dream Play. In A Dream Play, Indra's daughter comes down to Earth to better understand the plight of humanity. Strindberg structured this play using a dream logic that was later adopted by Expressionist playwrights. Paul Walsh translated all five plays in Cutting Ball's 2012 Strindberg cycle, The Chamber Plays in Rep, joins me in studio, along with Artistic Director Rob Melrose. Gentlemen, welcome to Open Air.
Thank you. Thanks, David. Great to be back.
Well, there's a lot in that opening paragraph that I need some need some splaining to do here. First of all, let's get on board with who Indra was. Maybe Rob Melrose can tackle that.
Oh, so Indra is the Vedic god, kind of. I mean, if you know, in Strindberg's view, I mean, at this point of his life, he's looking at Buddhism, he's looking at Hinduism, all different kinds of religions, and he's kind of mixing them all together. So it's kind of Indra's daughter's visit to Earth. He talks in the play about Indra's son visiting Earth, and it's obvious from the text that he means Jesus, and so it's kind of this Strindbergian mix of religions in the play.
And dream logic comes into play. What is dream logic?
Well, it's the first.
Is it like cartoon logic?
Well, it's that this is our dream season, and all three plays that we did this year have to do with dreams. But what's exciting about a dream play is the first play where a playwright said, I want to write a play with the structure of a dream, with the logic of a dream, where characters transform and shift, and one scene magically leads to another without an obvious connection. And that it's more associative, and it was written over 100 years ago, and it's way ahead of its time. It influenced the Expressionists, the Absurdists, the Surrealists, and without this play, we wouldn't have films like Inception, Memento, Wild Strawberries, Vanilla Sky, all these movies that that employ this kind of dream logic.
That's Rob Melrose. Paul Walsh, you've been associated with Strindberg for a long time. Anything to contribute to that thoughts about dream logic?
Well, Strindberg has really haunted me for 40 years of my life, and I went off to Sweden. I learned Swedish in order to try to understand this enigmatic play.
Really?
Without much success.
but, so you can translate whatever the hell you want. I mean, it's not really going to matter.
Well, it's a well-known play, and, you know, there's five or six Strindberg scholars out there that would me to task. So, but the opportunity to really work on this play with Cutting Ball and with Rob has been such a gift, because it's reminded me of just how present this play is and how immediate it is. And this notion of – and Strindberg was very much aware that he was writing a new kind of play. In fact, he didn't even give it a title. He gave it sort of a generic, like a tragedy, a comedy, a dream play. And he stuck with that. Originally, he called the play The Growing Castle, but he got rid of the title when he published the play to say, this is something that's so new, it doesn't even have a title yet.
Wow.
And now we know it as a dream play, and that has become its title. But to remember that he was creating a new experience for his audience through this, giving them the experience of watching something that was so like a dream, and so enigmatic like a dream, that you set aside trying to interpret as you go along and leave that to after the dream is over.
Wow. Well, Paul, you mentioned that you studied Swedish specifically to learn more about Strindberg's works and to translate them. When did you first encounter? You must have first encountered a translation.
Oh, yes. I first read them in translation in the late 70s. I was at the University of Minnesota and had the opportunity to study with a great Strindberg scholar, Johan Stockenström. And through his insistence, I got a grant from the Swedish government to go to Sweden, learn Swedish, and hang out.
So we have you to thank for some translations that probably would not have been brought to light of day. Is that correct?
Well, certainly not in the particular tone that I give them. Because I'm a person of the theater rather than a literary scholar, I strive in my translations to make these both playable by the actors and speakable by the actors. And so they have less of a literary quality and more of a theatrical quality.
Is that your motivation for your particular translations, then? Is that what you saw in the existing translations that seemed a little bit stilted for the stage?
Oftentimes, stilted and also sometimes just old. Language changes so quickly, and the language on the stage has to be very present in the moment of performance. So I really strive for that. And work in rehearsal with the actors. We make changes. We made cuts in this play. We made changes that fit better into the mouths of the actors. That's remained true to both the tone and the temper and the authenticity of the text, but there's a lot of variety available in translating.
Well, Paul Walsh, you bring up the actors involved in this a dream play. Rob Melrose, maybe you can tell us a little bit about your cast.
Oh, well, two of them people have already seen in the Strindberg cycle. Ponder Goddard and Carl Hovig were both in that, and Ponder was actually my student when she was a freshman in high school, and I saw her through four years when I was teaching at Marin Academy, and she went on to NYU, and then went to London to study, and then came back and played Mother Ubu in Ubu Hua for us.
And that was wonderful.
And yes, she's just terrific. And so she's Agnes / Indra's daughter in this production, and she just does a wonderful job. And then there's Josh Schell, who was Peleas in our production of Peleas and Melisande. And then lots of wonderful Kunal Prasad, who I talked about, he's playing the poet, which is kind of the Strindberg figure in the play, and he does a wonderful job as well.
And I can add that it was actually in meeting Ponder that I was finally convinced to stop procrastinating and translate this play, because Ponder has the sensibility that's necessary for this excruciating and very funny role of Agnes, or Indra's daughter.
Oh, so we're not just going to be treated to some surreal dream sequences. There's actually some humor involved. There's some. Tell us about.
It's very funny. I mean, that's the thing that when you read it, it's hard to tell how funny it is. But in the playing of it, you can see why the absurdists loved this play, because we're really looking at it as our production. Takes place in a room in it with a bed, and we're looking at it as a very kind of end of life play, and as someone kind of looking at kind of having this experience of in 90 minutes, which is the length of the play, of experiencing every aspect of life, and every aspect of what life is all about, And so can go to some really deep places, but at the same time, the absurdity of life comes through loud and clear, and there are many very, very funny scenes as well.
The couple of preview audiences that we've had have surprised themselves with their laughter out loud because it's not a funny topic. Indra's daughter comes down to Earth to see if humanity seem to complain all the time and whether they have any real reason to complain. And her response is, well, yes, they do. Life is really hard, you know, and only humans can do it. It's actually too hard for the gods. So it's very funny in its approach, and it's also sort of gruesomely funny in its juxtaposition of contradictions within life.
And this the dream play runs through June 19th. Tonight's a special night. In fact, Paul Walsh will be having a special meet and greet with the audience to mm-hmm. learn about the art of translation. What can you share with us on air to encourage people to show up tonight at 6?
Well, I'll talk about Strindberg and his enigmatic life. And, you know, this is a man who died at age 63, but his collected works are 8 million words. You know, he wrote... It's true, he wrote 63 plays, but he also wrote novels and scientific papers and a history of Sweden seen from the point of view of the Swedish people. So I'll talk a bit about that, and then I'll talk about the personal traumas of translating this play and the number of times I had to throw the pencil across the room and the dog ran away because he was terrified. And also the...
No, but we should add that no animals were harmed in the creation.
Absolutely true. And... The 30 years I spent procrastinating and why. So,
what are you working on now? Are you working on further Strindberg or other Swedish? Are you delving into other plays?
Right now, I also translate from Norwegian. So right now, I've done a translation of John Gabriel Borkman, a late play by Ibsen, for the Stratford Festival that Carrie Perloff from ACT will be directing this summer. So
fantastic.
I'm looking forward to that.
Nice. Rob Melrose, this is Say It Ain't So, your swan song here at the Cutting Ball as artistic director. Is that
yes.
true and why?
It is. It's my last play as artistic director, but the good news is the new artistic director is my wife, Paige Rogers. So I have an in there. So if I want to come back, and I'll still be on the
it's
board,
kind of like the Clinton, maybe the Clinton
yes,
thing.
It's very very much like that. Very much like that. These past 5 years, I've had the chance to direct at the Guthrie Theater, the Public Theater, and the Oregon Shakespeare Festival in the Old Globe. And I've really enjoyed my freelance career. And Paige and I got to a point where we just said, you know, Paige was really excited about running it, and I was really excited about doing more things outside of the Bay Area and outside of Cutting Ball. And so we kind of switched roles, and we're both excited and recharged. So Paige has got people may see their banners up all over San Francisco of our next season, and so Paige has got new energy, and Cutting Ball is going to be, I think, even stronger for her new energy. So I'm very excited.
Well, she's a real sweetheart, and I've talked with her on air several times, and I'm sure we'll have her back to talk about the new season of Cutting Ball.
Fantastic.
Rob Melrose, Paul Walsh, thanks for coming in today. It's Cutting Ball's new translation of Strindberg's A Dream Play Through the 19th. Information at cuttingball.com. We've got a bit of the sound design now from Cliff Carruthers, who created the sound score for Dream Play. Let's hear that as we once again thank you for coming in, guys.
Thank you so much.
Should be going.
It is playing.
Not hearing it. Let's bring the iPhone up to the microphone here.
Should be playing.
All right, and here's a play button. It's a very quiet soundscape. More theater ahead from we'll be hearing about what's happening at the Marsh, as well as some great music coming in terms of a little bit of there we go. The Cliff Carruthers soundscape.
And
for a dream play. Go ahead, Rob.
Yeah, Cliff's created an incredibly rich 90 minutes of solid music, and a lot of people have left the theater saying that his soundscape was worth the price of admission. He's a real genius, and he's been working with us for 15 years, and it's not to be missed.
Thanks, Rob. Still to come, some music from Benjamin Britten as well as Mark Blitzstein. All ahead here on Open Air. Stay with us. Continuing our theater theme here on Open Air, Lightning in the Rain is by a work that Corey Fisher is starring in at The Marsh here on Valencia Street in San Francisco. Corey is an actor, writer, director, and composer who has been creating and performing theater for over 45 years. In 1978, he co-founded Traveling Jewish Theater, with which he collaborated on more than two dozen works. His last project with the theater was In the Maze of Our Own Lives, based on the history of the famed group theater. Corey also worked with visionary director Joseph Chaykin and the legendary improv group The Committee, and appeared in several films, including MASH, McCabe and Mrs. Miller, Funny Lady, B-Season, as well as dozens of TV shows. He also teaches, coaches, and consults privately, and he talks with us today on Open Air. Corey, welcome to Open Air.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure to be back. It's been way too long.
You will be the second. You're the first of two 71-year-olds that I'll be talking with later on in this hour. I'll be visiting via pre-tape with Kathleen Shelfant, who is at the Berkeley Rep.
Oh, she is so great.
So you both have such rich histories in the theater. Tell me a little bit about what motivated you early on.
I think what motivated me most strongly were the unlived lives of my parents, because my father had been in showbiz, as they say. He was ultimately a stage manager, but his real ambition was to be a song and dance man, a hoofer. He wound up stage managing a couple of original Gershwin musicals with Fred and Adele Astaire. And wow. my mother, on the other hand, had done political theater in Chicago in the 30s. So their best moments, when they told me stories about their youths, were all about theater and performance.
Born to the stage, you were.
I guess so.
And where was this?
L.A.
In L.A., wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, everyone thinks I'm from New York, but no, I'm a West Coast guy.
Other siblings that were also bit by the theater bug?
Only child.
Oh, my gosh. Okay, yeah. I can see you in the tap shoes already.
I'm working on some of the grandkids, though. We have six, so there's still hope. And one of them is a fantastic dancer already at age 13.
So tell us about Lightning in the Brain.
Well, Lightning in the Brain refers to my experience of, at age 70, for the first time, having had a seizure, a full-out epileptic seizure. No memory of how it happened. Wound up on the floor. My wife, fortunately, was able to call the paramedics. And here's an interesting coincidence, because I noticed on your bio that you have narrated Peter and the Wolf.
Indeed, yeah.
Okay, so the day before my seizure, I was narrating Peter and the Wolf.
Let that be a warning.
And, you know, as I say in the piece, I used to be able to do that kind of thing in my sleep.
Uh-huh.
But at 70, it's different. Hmm. And I thought I was just overtired. I went back to bed, and the next thing I knew, my wife was calling my name. I was on the floor, and guys were putting me on a stretcher.
Wow.
So it's all under control. Yeah. That was over a year ago. I'm fine.
In an otherwise very healthy lifestyle and whatever you were doing leading up to that. That's fascinating.
Yeah. The neurologist.
Scary. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, it was. It was. The aftermath was scary. Like, what happened? Where did that slice of time go? Because I had no memory. It was like just a splice.
Hmm.
And fortunately, my wife, she's a writer, China Galland, and she loves to document whatever she can. It's a necessity with her. So while she was rousing me off the floor, she was shooting a video on her iPhone. And thank God she did, because the neurologist, until she saw the video, kept saying there was nothing wrong with me. When she looked at the video, just as I was coming to, but there was a totally vacant look in my eye. And the neurologist said, in a very strong Turkish accent, because that's where she's from, she said, "Definitely a seizure. This is a seizure." And she gave me the medication. We worked to find the right one. And that was number one. 3 months later, I had a second one.
Hmm.
but none since. So it's been over a year.
And they still don't know a cause of it.
There is no physiological reason in my brain or anywhere else in my body. Or if there is, it's too subtle for them to see. But it's led me in some very interesting areas. I've always been interested in neuroscience. I don't know why, but now I had more motivation. And I began to find out everything I could about memory, consciousness, which we know very little about still. And that's definitely a strong theme in the piece. Strangely, a friend of mine who's a playwright, when he saw it, said, you know, at the beginning we think it's going to be about memory loss, but in fact it's a piece about reliving memories.
Recalling.
Yeah, because my concern about memory led me to actively remembering, discovering what was there, and it was enormous. And I began just kind of pouring out, you know, sheet after sheet of when I was this age, I did that. When I was that age, I did that. And it was a flood of memory, which gives me a lot of pleasure. And in doing the piece, I get to literally relive in my mind, my nervous system, my body, what I'm talking about. And that's an amazing gift.
And we get to share, you get to share with us your time in Paris in the 1960s.
Paris, 1960s, LA in the 50s, 70s, 80s, a little snippet of North Africa in the late 60s when I hitchhiked from Tangiers to Tunis. You could do that back then in 1964.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. Who did you develop this work with?
Naomi Newman, who I have been working with since 1968. We met in L.A. in an acting class. We were then in an improv group together, which she directed. We started Traveling Jewish Theater together. And when it ended in 2012, 4 years ago, we were both incredibly depressed for about a year. Then we each started working on things, and it was Naomi who convinced me to make a new piece. I played her some songs I'd written, thinking maybe I'd do some open mics, get back to my old folky days. She said, no, you're an actor. These songs need to be in a piece. There needs to be story. So I accepted the assignment, and 2 years later, here we are.
It's interesting that you just followed our discussion with the Cutting Ball folks about Strindberg's dream play, and here,
wow,
and here your brain is coming to the fore in some memories of your own life brought to the stage.
And there's a literal dream in the piece. A very unusual dream I had about a great uncle of mine who I never met because he disappeared when my mother was a kid. So
wow.
There you go.
Uh-huh.
I owe a lot to Strindberg's dream play, and we all do, as Rob and Paul so eloquently put it.
You mentioned your time as a folky. Are we going to hear some of your music in the show, or what did you use for music for the show?
Yeah, it's all my about 9 original songs, all of which are autobiographical. They're stories in song. And there's one traditional song, but I rewrote the lyrics to Freight Train.
Okay.
Because there's a reference to that. I, you know, when I was a kid in the 50s and 60s, I actually got to go to an arts camp where Pete Seeger led the folk music workshop. Because
wow.
In those days, in the 50s, he could not get work in many places.
That's right, yeah.
That was the gift of all gifts, because he brought up amazing musicians, and I got to learn some blues riffs from players like Brownie McGee, who's not that well known these days. He was like a little below the fame of Lightning Hopkins or Howlin' Wolf, but shaped my life. And the idea of passing these stories on, being at this stage of life I am, is extremely important. There's also a lot of history in the piece, which I did not intend to do, but as I was telling this stuff, for context, you know, I mentioned the day my mother was rocking me, and when you know, I was less than 2 years old, and she heard the news on the radio of Franklin Roosevelt being having died, and she would tell me that story over and over. My grandmother's stories about coming to America, my father's stories about showbiz, my own stories about leaving Hollywood when I had a chance to run off with a fairly activist political theater group from L.A. in 1976. Mm-hmm. Big change. That's when I decided to only do theater for a while, because that's what I loved. And the life I was living as a, you know, sort of a character actor trying to get a line more each job was boring and unsatisfying.
But now you're back on the stage proper, where you belong, apparently, Corey Fisher. Corey Fisher's show, Lightning in the Brain, is at the Marsh on Valencia Street, that great incubator of wonderful new playwrights and one-man shows. The Marsh on 1062 Valencia. Lightning in the Brain runs through July 9th. Corey Fisher, it's a pleasure that you can share your life with us here on the air and on the stage at the Marsh. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, David.
Well, continuing with Open Air today, we're going to hear some great music coming up ahead, Benjamin Britten's War Requiem excerpts, as well as the rarely heard Mark Blitzstein Airborne Symphony, which I'll be narrating, and Brian Thorsett will be featured soloist with an ensemble by Curious Flights. Curious Flights artistic director Brendan Guy will be here. That ensemble will be conducted by Alistair Neal. We'll hear about that shortly. And as I mentioned, a second 70-odd-year-old conversation on this week's Open Air. Well, if you've ever experienced the loss of a parent, or even if you haven't, you will at some point, you'll be able to relate to the current production at Berkeley Rep for Peter Pan on her 70th birthday, which runs through July 3rd. Bay Area native Kathleen Chalfant leads a talented cast that includes one of her former Broadway castmates, Ellen McLaughlin. They acted together in the amazing original Broadway production of Tony Kushner's Angels in America. In addition to Angels, Kathleen starred on Broadway in Margaret Edson's amazing Wit and has been seen on the small screen recently playing recurring roles in House of Cards, Law and Order, Rescue Me, and The Guardian. She currently plays Margaret Butler in The Affair on Showtime. After last night's performance, I caught up with Ms. Chalfant at Berkeley Rep.
From university.
Kathleen, thank you for taking some time after your show, and congratulations on such a moving performance.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
It must be great having such a prominent stage role so close to your hometown of San Francisco.
It is a great, it's wonderful, and I have actually two hometowns in the Bay Area, because I was born in San Francisco, but from the sixth grade until I graduated from university, I lived in Oakland on Fruitvale Avenue.
Okay, now you're back in town here. I understand you're living in Brooklyn now. Where in Brooklyn are you?
We live in Brooklyn Heights. We lived in the West Village until 2 years ago, and then we sold our house and moved to Brooklyn Heights in part to be nearer our youngest grandchild.
Very nice, and have a beautiful view of Lower Manhattan, no doubt.
We don't, actually. We have a beautiful view of the houses across the street, which are very beautiful, and a 19th century firehouse. So it's nice.
I know Brooklyn Heights well. My partner and I lived in Brooklyn in Park Slope for 15 years before coming out here. So we know it quite well. And you get to fly. How much fun is that in this show?
That is more fun than I can tell you. It's only thrilling. It's wonderful. I get to fly and to fence. At this time in my life, that's quite a thing. It's just wonderful.
Well, let's get people on board with a Cliff Notes synopsis of the work, if you had Sarah Rules play for Peter Pan on her 70th birthday.
The play is about a large Irish Catholic family, five siblings. It is in three movements. It begins around the hospital deathbed of the family patriarch. It then moves to a kind of impromptu wake in their family home. And then the final movement is a dream of Peter Pan in which the entire family is involved.
Which your character was involved with the production early on in her life.
Yes, my character in the play played Peter Pan three times and met Mary Martin once and had her picture taken with Mary Martin.
And not to give anything away, had a very positive relationship with her father, who really appreciated her role in the performance.
He loved her in Peter Pan.
Now, were you familiar with Sarah Rule's work, or did you just get familiar from your work on her play, Dear Elizabeth, last fall?
This is actually the fourth of Sarah's plays I've done. The first was Dead Man's Cell Phone, and the second was Sarah's passion play, and then Dear Elizabeth last fall. And we've been doing workshops for Peter Pan for almost 2 years, I think. So we've been able, the three of us who were in it from the beginning, have been able to watch the play develop.
Well, you recently did a one-woman show of Rose Kennedy's life called Rose in New York. I'm wondering what research was involved for that. In this day and age, you don't necessarily need to go to the Kennedy compound or read the letters or go to the library, but what sort of research did you have to do to research Rose Kennedy for a stage performance?
Well, the playwright, Lawrence Leamer, had written a book called The Kennedy Women because he was very interested in a way, the tragedy of the Kennedy women. And he'd done, lucky for me, all the research. So I read Larry's book, and there was quite a... The play was biographical, so there was quite a lot of biographical material in the play. And, of course, I was there because I was born in 1945, and I remember the Kennedy years, and I think from the moment that Jack Kennedy became the president, the Kennedys for most of my formative years were the royal family of America.
Any direct contact with the Kennedy clan for that?
No. I don't think anyone from the family came. Someone who had been... who had written a book about Rosemary. There's a new, quite wonderful and very moving book about Rosemary Kennedy. And the author of that book came. And it was very important in the play to the circumstances of the family's treatment of Rosemary. And we were pleased to see that she thought we'd got it right. So that was good.
Well, looking back, I mentioned that I lived in New York at the same time, my partner and I, when you did the wonderful Tony-nominated role on Angels in America back in 1993. And here you are united with one of your Angels co-stars, Ellen McLaughlin, who played the angel in Angels in America. So she was flying now, you're flying now.
I learned everything I know about flying from watching Ellen. We were together in the play for 6 years, starting doing developmental work at the Taper, and then we came to San Francisco, the production in San Francisco. So I watched her fly for 6 years, and finally I get to be in the air with her. It's wonderful.
Well, this play for Peter Pan on her 70th birthday forces one to deal with end-of-life issues, the older siblings coming together to say goodbye, a final goodbye to their father. You were involved also in the play Wit back in New York, which unfortunately I missed, but also deals with end-of-life issues. And you drew on your own personal experience of your stepbrother.
My half-brother.
Your half-brother. So is end-of-life plays something that's going to be your forte now?
I hope not, in the same way that I hope that end of life itself holds off for a little bit. But I'm now 71, so and because the baby boom generation is so enormous, there are now many, many plays dealing with these issues because we are dealing with the most of us have dealt with the loss of parents, and we are parents and grandparents, and we have to consider what will happen for our children when we're the people in the bed, which we will inevitably be because there's only one way out of here.
The play also touches on issues of religion versus or in tandem with philosophy. One memorable line deals with at our age in terms of siblings in their 70s, one either has to find religion or Carl Jung.
Yes, yes. The family are, for the most part, lapsed Catholics in various stages of lapse. And one of the youngest sister, the part that played by Ellen, is a Buddhist. And I say of my character, I still take communion to be sociable. I do miss it, the affiliation. So as people often say, once a Catholic, always a Catholic.
Recovering Catholic myself, youngest of seven.
So you know about this.
I do indeed.
Did the Catholic parts ring true to you?
Absolutely. I can't decide whether I'm more jealous of you and your castmates flying in the play or whether your dying father getting the foot massage every night.
These are both very important elements in the play and moments of great delight for the people who get to do them.
Well, in addition to your stage work, we know you from your recurring role on House of Cards. Not a shabby franchise to be associated with.
Not at all. Lucky me. And I also recur on a television show called The Affair. And interestingly enough, both those characters are named Margaret. They are both the richest women in the world. And they wear Carolina Herrera. I don't know. That's not a bad franchise to have either. The clothes are fabulous.
Classic question for an actor, and maybe it is. It's answered by whatever I can get. Stage or screen, small screen, large screen?
As you said, whatever I can get. I've been very, very lucky to be able. I've gotten to do wonderful things in the theater, and I got started in New York working on new plays, so most of my work has been on new plays, and to have been able to be in Angels in America and Wit in the same lifetime is pretty great. And it's fun to be on the television, especially as a recurring character. If you're playing one of the leads in one of those shows, it's very like industrial work because it's all day, every day, the better part of 6 days a week. But if you recur, it's all the good parts of TV and none of the bad parts.
Different approaches to preparing for that situation on television versus a stage.
I'm not. People ask this all the time, and I've come to believe that there isn't actually a great deal of difference. What you do in all cases is to fill the available space in the way you do in life. And so typically the available space in movies and television is smaller than in the theater. But the job is still the same, to communicate what it is that you're saying to the person you're talking to.
In an intimate way, whether it's 2 feet away in one's home or if it's the last row in the house.
Yeah. I mean, for instance, this play, this theater, the Rota Theater, is an enormous theater. And the play is actually quite an intimate play. So the emotions that we're communicating are intimate emotions, but we have to fill the space so that the people all the way in the back get to experience the play, too.
Kathleen Chalfant, in her 71st year, thank you for portraying Peter Pan on her 70th birthday.
Thank you very much for having me, and I thank them for letting me do it, even though I'm a little bit too old for the part.
Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
for Peter Pan on her 70th birthday runs through July 3rd at Berkeley Rep. More information at berkeleyrep.org. Incidentally, SHN, the traveling touring musical production company here in San Francisco, just announced that Finding Neverland will be part of their 2016-17 season. So if you didn't get enough of Peter Pan now, come January, you'll get the roots of Peter Pan. Benjamin Britten from the War Requiem, the Dies Irae. The Berkeley Community Chorus and Orchestra will bring Benjamin Britten's monumental War Requiem to Hertz Hall at UC Berkeley next week. These performances will be the culmination of a year-long celebration of the BCCO's 50th anniversary, which included a lecture series about Britten's life and work and poetry readings at the Berkeley Public Library. The War Requiem is conceived on a grand scale and calls for two separate orchestras, a full orchestra as well as a chamber orchestra, a large chorus, a children's chorus, organ, and three soloists, one of which joins me in studio today to talk about the production, tenor Brian Thorsett, joined by the BCCO's music director. Ming Luke is the only third music director for the BCCO in its 50-year history. In addition to this ensemble, he's worked with ensembles around the world and has been primary guest conductor with the San Francisco Ballet here in town for the past several seasons. Ming is also music director of the Merced Symphony in the California Central Valley, and this season has engagements with, among others, the Houston Symphony, Nashville Symphony and Ballet, as well as Opera San Jose. Ming, welcome back to our airwaves.
Thank you.
And Brian Thorsett has been building an international career in opera, oratorio, and recital. I've had the pleasure of collaborating with him on several projects. He's been seen and heard in over 100 diverse operatic roles in works ranging from Monteverdi to Britten to Rameau, as well as in pieces composed specifically for him. He's a graduate of the Merula program from San Francisco Opera. He's also studied with the Glimmerglass Opera's Young American Artist Program and American Bach Soloists Academy, as well as the Britten Pairs Young Artist Program in England, which no doubt informs his production of Britten's War Requiem. Brian recently moved to the other coast and is currently on the faculty of Virginia Tech. Brian, welcome back to our airwaves.
Thanks for having me.
Well, the War Requiem is such an amazing work, and I have to state right off that it's our song, so to speak. My partner and I met during a production of performance of the War Requiem back in 1987, New York Philharmonic, Rostropovich conducting the New York Phil with Vishnikaya as one of the soloists. So, oddly enough, the Britten War Requiem is our song. Odd piece to happen. Well, central to the work, Ming, is the poetry of Wilfred Owen. What do we know about Wilfred Owen?
So this is one of the most spectacular aspects of the War Requiem is that Britten doesn't just use the traditional Latin text. He superimposes, includes a lot of poetry of a World War I poet, Wilfred Owen, who was a soldier during the war and wrote really tragically about the horrible aspects of war. And so by combining the English poetry with the Latin text itself creates a lot of incredible poignant moments. And for instance, I think we have a recording of this, but, there's one section where in the Latin text it says that the salvation of all humankind has been promised to Abraham and his seed. And there is a poem where Wilfred Owen talks about the parable of Abram and his son, and where he takes his son to be slaughtered at, you know, on top of the mountain, and an angel stops him. But in Wilfred Owen's poem, he changes the parable so that Abram ignored the angels cries and slaughters his son. And I think the text is something similar to, you know, and so the sons of Europe one by the seed of Europe one by one. And then the children's choir sings above it, and the chorus comes back with that same Latin text, but in a completely different atmosphere, completely shell-shocked pianissimo. The music is literally backwards and sings again that same Latin text, you know, Abraham, as was promised to Abraham and his seed. And so there's a lot of moments through the entire work where the combination of Wilfred Owen's poems and the original Latin text really create these incredible moments.
Let's hear a bit of that moment you just talked about, and then we'll talk more about the Requiem and get Brian involved in the conversation. So Abram rose, an excerpt from Benjamin Britten's War Requiem.
And clave the wood, and went and took the file with him and the knife. And as they sojourned both of them together,
Isaac, the firstborn, spake and said, "My father, my father."
Text of the Bible adapted by poet Wilfred Owen for Benjamin Britten's War Requiem. Just amazing writing in there. And Brian, as tenor, you get to be a part of that aria as well.
Yeah, it's actually, you know, with all great composers, there's a lot of self-borrowing, and that actual entire section is lifted from his second canticle, which is actually called Abraham and Isaac. You know, he readapted it for baritone and tenor as opposed to the original alto or countertenor and tenor. And it's just that, you know, it's heartbreaking if you're a Britain nerd like myself and, you know, have this wonderful moment of salvation that happens in the canticle. Instead, he pulls the carpet out from under you and slaughters the sun over the beautiful, gorgeous, angelic music that he created in the canticle.
Amazing. Yeah. Amazing. This piece was written to rededicate the Coventry Cathedral in 1962, which was destroyed by World War II bombs. Wilfred Owen himself in World War I was shell-shocked and hospitalized, and it was during this hospitalization where he had these vivid, vivid dreams of what was happening to him. A lot of his dreams focused on eyes being gouged out or missing eyes. And apparently while he was in hospital, he refined his poetry through a mentor that was there, and then he just was able to channel a lot of this into some amazing prose and poetry. Stunning stuff. Ming, you've assembled quite a force for this 50th anniversary special concert.
Yes, we you know, we wanted to take this opportunity, as everybody does during anniversaries, to think about what history has led BCCO to be what it is today. And our fall concert basically commemorated that. We picked repertoire from the various three music directors and, you know, commissioned new work for the ensemble as well. But for the spring concert, we wanted to try to show a little bit about what BCCO, as a result of our history, can do. You know, this is a very large chorus of over 200 people. We engage an orchestra for every single concert. And pulling together the community is really what the organization is about. It's about trying to make music accessible to everybody, not only in listening to it, but in performance as well. And so there's very few of the chorus members that have performed a work as complicated as this before. And as you mentioned, you know, there are two orchestras. There's a children's chorus, there's organ, there's three soloists, two that are with the chamber orchestra only, and then the soprano soloist only singing in Latin with a larger chorus. But it's logistically can be very difficult, but because BCCO is such a large organization, we wanted to take on the challenge.
Performances are next Friday, June 3rd at 8, and Saturday, June 4th at 4 p.m., and a final performance on Sunday at June 5th at 4 p.m. All of the BCCO concerts are free and open to the public. Donations, of course, are welcome. More information at bcco.org. Ming Luke, thanks so much for sharing a little bit about this massive work. We could spend a full hour on it sometime. In fact, I'd love to talk with you more on it.
Yeah, thank you.
I'm going to ask Brian Thorsett to stay nearby on microphone to talk about his performances this weekend. Curious Flights concludes its 2015-16 season this Saturday, the 28th, with the West Coast premiere of Mark Blitstein's World War II epic, The Airborne Symphony, for orchestra, men's chorus, solo voices, and narrator. Marin Symphony Music Director Alistair Neal will lead the combined forces of the Curious Flights Symphony and a chorus, Marilla Opera grads Brian Thorsett, and Efren Sullis as baritone, and myself, David LaTulipe, as narrator, will be in this rare performance that marks the 70th anniversary of its world premiere, and again, its West Coast premiere. The full program will also include music of Aaron Copland and Samuel Barber and songs of Eric Korngold. Also joining me in studio is Brendan Guy, the artistic director of Curious Flights, for a brief conversation about this wonderful work and the interesting work that Curious Flights has been doing. Brendan, welcome to our airwaves once again.
Thanks, David. Good to be here.
I should also mention that Brendan is a marvelous clarinetist.
Oh, thank you very much.
So this piece, how did you come across this? I mean, it seems like it's been buried for so long.
It has been, but credit must go to my dear friend and colleague, Noah Luna. He came to me 3 years ago, actually, when we first founded Curious Flights, and he said, Brendan, I've got this amazing piece. We've got to do it. And I was hesitant at first because it's so big. It's a, you know, as you've already described, large orchestra, men's chorus, two solo singers, and narrator. And we're a new organization. And I thought to myself, this is going to be difficult. But as soon as I listened to it, I knew instantly that we had to do it. It embodies everything that Curious Flights is about. We present new and rarely performed music.
Mm-hmm. And the original being done by Orson Welles, who we'll hear shortly. I've got some footsteps to follow in then,
yes.
as a narrator. And Brian, tell me about the there's some beautiful writing for tenor in this.
Yeah, there's some wonderful, stunning music in it. You know, Blitstein has this, he's walking that same path that Bernstein did with the classical bent and also musical theater and creating this very distinctly American sounding music. And, you know, there are recitatives as we know them, with the baritone and the tenor, you know, kind of spoken and sparse music. But then there are the more lyrical passages, like you talk about it. There's a whole opening number about man's failed attempts to fly all the time, and, you know, literal crash and burns at that. And then there's this gorgeous, stunning, I don't know what to call it, an aria or solo for the baritone called The Ballad of the Bombardier, which is one of the most famous pieces and really excerptable and has been heard at many a vocal jury as being a teacher. Mm-hmm. And it, you know, tells that wonderful story of the young man going off and maybe not coming back.
Mm. This was originally intended as a film project that never came to fruition, but Leonard Bernstein became a champion. He was a good friend of Mark Blitzstein's and at least got some incredible recording done of it. And now we're going to be treated to it tomorrow evening under the direction of Alistair Neal. Brian Thorsett singing the tenor role, as well as our baritone soloist, Efren Solis. Excellent. So we do have a couple of pairs of tickets for this performance. If you call 415-841-4134, 415-841-4134, we have a pair of tickets available, and then a discount code for those who don't get in on the initial two tickets, 415-841-4134. The performance will be at the San Francisco Conservatory Saturday evening at 8 p.m. Brian Thorsett, thanks so much for coming in, doing double duty here on the West Coast. We should have a little flat for you somewhere, a crash pad, make you come back more often. And Brendan Guy, wonderful performance I'm anticipating on Saturday in addition to the Airborne Symphony, everything else involved with the concert. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
We're going to hear that Ballad of the Bombardier as we go out today. This is from the recording that featured Orson Welles, and we'll hear Leonard Bernstein leading forces in this recording of Mark Blitzstein's Airborne Symphony excerpt. And that very brief excerpt from Mark Blitzstein's Airborne Symphony. Tickets available, 415-841-4134, 415-841-4134. Curious Flights presents not only the Airborne Symphony, but music of Eric Korngold and Eric Korngold, Aaron Copland, and Samuel Barber on this special concert tomorrow evening this Saturday evening at the San Francisco Conservatory Music at 8. Yours truly, David LaTulipe, will be narrator for the Airborne Symphony, in a work that was originally narrated by the great Orson Welles.
My heart's one cry, foolish words that I wish to say and try.
That's Open Air for today. Join me next week at the same time for our radio magazine of the performing arts. My thanks to Niels Swinkels for producing the show. Our shows are archived at klw.org. News from NPR, followed by the BBC NewsHour. This is KLW, San Francisco.